All right, where are we? Oh, I'm back to the presentation, right? Stand by for vectors, Victor. Oh, we were going to talk about looking now into a microscope, right? See this? This is what the Darwinists say we all evolved from. This is a one-celled amoeba. The Darwinists say this was a little blob of protoplasm. And back then, they thought, well, maybe natural forces could come put this thing together, and then natural selection could take over, and here we all are. But back then, they didn't know what was in an amoeba. Now we do. In fact, in order to show you what's in an amoeba, I got to take you to your breakfast table. How many people in here like alphabet cereal? Anyone like alphabet cereal? All right, let's suppose you want to have a bowl of alphabet cereal. You're a teenager. You come downstairs one day to have a bowl of alphabet cereal, and you see the alphabet cereal is knocked over on the table, and right in the middle of the table, the letters spell, "Take out the garbage, Mom." What are you going to assume? Cat knocked the box over? Earthquake shook the house? No, you're going to say that's intelligent design from an intelligent being. Mom. Or you walk along the beach and you see in the sand, John loves Mary. What do you assume? The waves did that? Crabs came out of the water and made that message? No, you're going to say there had to be an intelligence there, right? Because you know that in all your experiences, messages only come from minds. They don't come from natural forces. Natural forces don't make messages. Well, if messages only come from minds, where does this message come from? DNA, the four-letter genetic alphabet that all of us have. In fact, all living things have DNA. You have DNA, I have DNA, a banana has DNA. And you know, inside every cell in your body, there's a message that's 3.5 billion letters long. All the letters are in the right order. That's the longest word we've ever discovered. It's inside of you. In the beginning was the Word. If take out the garbage, Mom, requires a mind, do you think a letter or a word or a message 3.5 billion letters long requires a mind? Yeah, exactly. Now you say, well, maybe it started really simple in an amoeba and it evolved from there. First of all, you know you can't evolve codes randomly. Can't do that. I mean, even if you were to give somebody, even if you were going to grant somebody, say, the code that makes Microsoft Word work, if you started to mutate that code randomly, how long would the program work? It hardly works now, right? I mean, it's just going to degrade itself. It's not going to work. So, where I come from, wherever there's a code, there's a coder. Wherever there's a program, there's a programmer. Wherever there is a message, there's a messenger. But let's just humor them. An amoeba. Maybe it started really simple and primitive. First of all, how big is an amoeba? You can line up several hundred amoebas in an inch. And how much of a genome is in an amoeba? How long is the message? The message in an amoeba is about 1,000 volumes worth of an encyclopedia in that microscopic little amoeba. Now, to believe that that resulted by natural forces without intelligence is like believing that the Library of Congress resulted from an explosion in a printing shop. Look, I don't have enough faith to believe that. The first life requires an intelligent cause. Now, you say, Frank, how do you even know this? Did some Christian tell you this? No, you know who told me there's that much information in an amoeba? Richard Dawkins. Even he admits this in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Now, by the way, this is not a God of the Gaps argument. I'm not making a God of the Gaps argument. What's a God of the Gaps argument? It's when you find something in nature you can't explain. So you have a gap in your knowledge, and so you plug God into that gap in knowledge, and you say, God did it. Later on, you find it's a natural cause. We're not doing that. Why? Because we don't just lack a natural explanation for this. It's that we have positive, empirically verifiable evidence for an intelligent being. When you see take out the garbage mom on your table, you don't just lack a natural explanation. That's positive evidence for an intelligent being, mom. Do you see what we're doing here? We're arguing not from what we don't know. We're arguing from what we do know. We do know that messages come from minds. In fact, let's go all the way back to the beginning. This is you in the beginning. This is you at 11 weeks. Question, is that animal, mineral, vegetable, or human?
Human.
In fact, let's go back even further. Let's go back to when your mother and your father got together. Have you guys had this talk before? I see some young people in here, so I'll try and be discreet. When your mother and your father got together, your father sent the entire population of the United States, 300 million soldiers, toward your mother's egg. And then there was a race. And you won. Don't let anyone ever tell you you're not special. You beat out 300 million others. You have blown away anything Michael Phelps has done. Now, seeing some of you limping here earlier makes it hard for me to believe you were the fastest soldier in the gene pool. But you were. Now, your soldier was 20 to 30 times smaller than a grain of salt, yet it contained half of the genetic information that makes you you. And your mother's egg was about the size of a period at the end of a sentence in an average book, and it contained the other half of the genetic information that makes you you. And when your soldier and your egg came together, a new 100% genetic human being was created. You know, you have not created any more genetic information from that point till right now. Your genetic information has just duplicated itself. In fact, from that point till right now, there were only four things separating you from adulthood: time, air, water, and food. Those are the same four things that separate a two-year-old from adulthood. Does this have implications on the abortion issue? Of course. We don't kill the two-year-old. Why do we kill the unborn child in the womb? You say the unborn child in the womb is not viable. Hey, I know some teenagers that aren't viable. You leave them alone, they're going to die. What does that prove? You say, well, you know, you can't legislate morality. No extra charge for this. All laws legislate morality. The only question is whose morality? Every law is trying to declare one behavior right and the opposite behavior wrong. Everybody's trying to legislate morality. The only question is whose morality? They say, don't impose your morality. I go, it's not my morality. I didn't make this up. I didn't make up the fact that murder is wrong, that abortion's wrong, that women were made for men and men were made for women, and when they come together, they make babies, and what's best for them is to have a mother and a father. I didn't make that up. That's not my morality. That's the morality. So I'm not trying to impose my morals. I'm saying, don't impose your morals. Don't impose my morals. Let's impose the morals. The morals that Jefferson said were self-evident. No extra charge for that. Let's go back to this. From that point till right now, a construction project of astonishing complexity began taking place. Cells began multiplying at a rate of 4,000 cells per second. Brain cells began multiplying at a rate of 100,000 cells per second. For most of you, anyway. Some cells became brain cells. Other cells became lung cells. Other cells became heart cells. How did they know how to do this? Nobody knows. Some cells went so far across you to become what they needed to become that it would be equivalent to you today walking across the United States alone. And that construction project continues to this day. You just made 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. Knock it off! How do you know how to do this? Are you thinking about this? Are you going, got to make more red blood cells? Hold on. Excuse me. You're not thinking. Well, how is this happening? In fact, this is an argument we don't use anymore. We should use more of it. It's in the new book, Stealing from God. It goes all the way back to Aristotle and picked up by Aquinas. It's called final causality. What is final causality? It means there's a goal-directedness toward everything in nature. Nature itself is goal-directed. Let me give you an example of this. Well, I've been giving you an example. You see how your embryo was goal-directed to become you? In fact, you know that scientists have done experiments on fruit fly embryos, where they try and divert the fruit fly embryo from its destination. And the fruit fly embryos, even though they're unconscious, make heroic attempts to get back on track to become a fruit fly. So the biologists are trying to make it go this way. It can't. They can't. It'll keep trying to get back on track. In fact, scientists get three possible outcomes from manipulating fruit fly embryos. They get a normal fruit fly embryo, they get a mutant fruit fly embryo, or they get a dead fruit fly embryo. Or a dead fruit fly, I should say. A normal fruit fly, a mutant fruit fly, or a dead fruit fly. They don't even get a horse fly, much less a horse. Why? Because nature is goal-directed. Why is an acorn, if properly nourished, always become an oak tree? Why doesn't it become an elm tree or a seahorse? Because it's goal-directed to become an acorn or become an oak tree. An acorn is goal-directed to become an oak tree. Now, is it conscious? Does it have a mind? No. Well, how does it do this then? Because there's an external mind directing it toward that end. Why does a human embryo become a human if properly nourished? Because there's an external mind directing it toward an end. Why does the moon rotate or go in orbit around the Earth? Is it conscious? Is the moon going, I got to go around the Earth? Why does it do it? Well, you say there's a law like gravity out there. Why does gravity keep doing what it's doing? Why do the laws of nature do what they do? There's only four fundamental forces out there. What are they? Anyone know? No, one of them is not a woman scorned, sir. I'm sorry. Gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear forces. Those are the only four known forces we know about. The only four forces we know about. And they're goal-directed. Why are they goal-directed? Why do they do the same thing over and over again? Why can we take a rover, build it here on Earth, launch it, put it on a planet 60 million miles away, Mars, with precision? Because we can rely on the laws of nature, the four fundamental forces, to do what they do repeatedly and constantly and consistently. Why? Because there's a mind behind them, goal-directing them. They're not conscious themselves. This is what Aristotle called final causality. This is what Aquinas called it as well. And now when you look at the biological world and you can peer inside the cell and you see all these sorts of molecular machines that have a goal to them and a direction to them, you go, wow, why has all this happened? You know, the atheists are saying that we got here through blind, purposeless forces and that our minds are the results of blind, purposeless forces. Really? Then why do we trust them? If they're the result of blind, purposeless forces. Random. We wouldn't even know what random was unless we knew what order was. Think about it. There's an order out there. This is why God is not just a creator. He doesn't just create the universe and then leaves it. He creates the universe and sustains it. He is to the universe what a band is to music. So that's why Paul, when he goes on Mars Hill, in Acts chapter 17, actually quotes a Cretan poet by the name of Epimenides. Epimenides said, in Zeus we live and move and have our being. Paul applies that quote to Yahweh. He says, in Yahweh we live and move and have our being. Paul says in Colossians chapter 1, Christ holds all things together. He's holding you and me and all of reality together right now. He's not just a distant creator cause, he's a sustainer cause. All right, let's do one more argument. The moral argument. 4 years ago, I had the opportunity to go across Europe with a couple of my sons and my friend Bob Cornuke, who's the real Indiana Jones. And we started in London, and we basically went across Europe to Berlin, just what the Allies did. And along the way, we stopped at the Buchenwald concentration camp in Weimar, Germany, right outside of Weimar, Germany. And in April of 1945, the Allies liberated the camp, and they went through the front gate, which is still there. They looked off to the right. They saw the crematorium about 100 yards off in the distance. It's still there. When they got down to the crematorium, they looked into the courtyard attached to the crematorium, And this is what they saw. Brace yourself. Now, if there is no God, this is just a matter of opinion. This is just your opinion against, say, Hitler's opinion. Hitler liked killing Jews. You say, well, no, killing Jews isn't good. If there's no standard beyond humanity, you can't say this is objectively wrong. You can't justify it. You can say it, but you can't justify it. No, we all know this is objectively wrong. In fact, how can you discover who's right and who's wrong? Mother Teresa, the Catholic nun who devoted herself to helping the poor in India, or Adolf Hitler, the mass murderer of World War II? Actually, Stalin was even more of a murderer than him. You say, how can you discover who's right and who's wrong? Well, let me ask you the question this way. How do you know which map of Scotland is better? What would you need to see in order to make a judgment? What would you need to see? Yeah, you would need to see a real unchanging place called Scotland, right? If Scotland doesn't exist, these two maps are meaningless. But since Scotland does exist, we can see map A, while it's not perfect, is a better representation of the real Scotland than is map B. Right? In other words, we measure both maps by an external, unchanging standard. That's the only way we can figure out which one is better. In order for something to be better than another thing, there has to be a best by which you can measure. This one is closer to the standard than is this one. That's exactly what we do when we compare Mother Teresa and Hitler. Mother Teresa wasn't the standard. Hitler wasn't the standard. There's a standard beyond both of them by which we measure both of them. And we say Mother Teresa measured up to the standard better than did Hitler. What is the standard? God's nature is the standard. God is the ground of good. Now, if there is no God, then what the Nazis did wasn't really wrong. I was at Michigan State a few years back during the Q&A of an I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist seminar. There were a couple of atheists sitting on this side of the room, and we got talking about morality during the Q&A, and I said, well, you're an atheist. How do you explain morality? And he said, well, one of them said, whatever the majority decides is morally right. And I said, are you telling me that if a majority in Nazi Germany or even a plurality decided it's okay to murder Jews and homosexuals and gypsies and Jehovah's Witnesses and anyone you found undesirable, that that would be morally right? And he blushed and he went, yes. And his atheist buddy sitting right next to him looked at him and yelled out, no! The first kid knew in his heart the answer was no, but in order to be consistent with his atheism, he had to say yes. Now, if you have to deny that the Holocaust was wrong, then you got the wrong worldview. In fact, David Silverman, the president of the American Atheists, I debated him a couple of years ago, and the debates are on our website for free, crossexamine.org, including a couple with Christopher Hitchens. And that's what he said. He said, yeah, we can't say the Nazis were wrong. I said, you just got the wrong worldview. It's more evident that the Nazis were wrong than it is that atheism's true. See, if the Nazis were wrong, there must be something really right, and if something's really right, then God exists. So evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, actually. It doesn't disprove God. In fact, of course, on atheism, majority. Who said majority? There is no standard. It's a free-for-all. Oh, the majority may decide, or one guy may say, I got a lot of power. I'm going to kill everybody who gets in my way. But he's not the standard of morality. There is no standard of morality if there is no God. Love is no better than rape. Not in an objective sense, anyway, if there's no God. There are no human rights. And this is hard to believe, but there are no human rights. I always hear atheists arguing for rights to this and rights to that. And, of course, the hot-button issues in our culture today, same-sex marriage and abortion and government-funded health care and all these things. And they say they have all these rights. Look, if there's no God, there's no right to anything. There's no right to life. There's no right to abortion. There's no right to natural marriage. There's no right to same-sex marriage. There's no right to anything. It's all a matter of opinion. In fact, this is why it was... I don't know if you saw this a couple of weeks ago on CNN. Chris Cuomo, who is the son of Mario Cuomo, the brother of Andrew Cuomo, who is the governor of New York, he's a CNN reporter. I know nobody knows this because nobody watches CNN. But anyway, he had Judge Roy Moore from Alabama on, and Cuomo tried to say, after Moore said our rights come from God, consistent with the Declaration of Independence, Cuomo said, no, our rights come from man. There are no rights if they come from man. Which man? Mother Teresa or Hitler? Who said? See, if there's no God, as Dostoevsky said, everything's permitted. It's all a matter of opinion. Tolerance is no better than intolerance. Question. Let me ask you guys a question. Are Christians commanded to be tolerant? Careful how you answer. No. Christians are commanded to be loving. You see, tolerance is too weak. Tolerance says, hold your nose and put up with them. Love says, reach out and help them. And in order to be loving, sometimes you can't tolerate evil that somebody's committing. In fact, you know this as parents. If you tolerate everything your kid does, are you a loving parent? No. You can't tolerate things that are evil. If you tolerate things that are evil, you're unloving. Isaiah says in Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. That's where we're heading in this country. We're beginning to call evil good and good evil. Religious crusades are not wrong. I always hear the atheists saying, well, you religious people have done evil in the crusades. In fact, Christopher Hitchens said that in one of our debates, and I said, yeah, well, Christopher, so what? If we have, according to your worldview, there's nothing wrong with that. If we're just molecules in motion, there's nothing wrong with crusades. Nothing wrong at all. Of course, you know, the whole crusade thing is overblown. Do you know what the crusades actually were? They were military responses to Muslim aggression in the Holy Land 400 years late after the fact. The first crusade was in 1095. Muslim aggression began in 632. Now, there were a lot of atrocities committed on the crusades, but many scholars say that they were just wars until the atrocities were committed to try and take back land that the Muslims had taken from the Christians. In any event, there's nothing wrong with anything if there's no God. So when an atheist points out all the evil done by religious people, you can agree with them. You know what? Religious people have done evil, but that shows if there is evil, there must be good, and if there is good, God must exist. So you're kind of proving our worldview. In fact, in the second debate, I told Christopher, I said, look, Christopher, I'm a hypocrite. I can't live up to this book. But if I could, I wouldn't need a savior. If I was perfect, I wouldn't need a savior. So when you say religious people have done evil things, you're kind of proving our worldview. We agree we've done evil. That's why we need a savior. And when people say, look, I can't go to church because there's too many hypocrites down there, I always say, come on down, pal, we got room for one more. It's what the church is. It's a hospital for sinners. It's not a country club for saints. Yes, I know we're saints theologically, but we're still all sinners. If we were perfect, we wouldn't need church. We wouldn't need one another. We wouldn't need God. And you can't complain about the problem of evil if there is no God. I've been hinting at this as we go. C.S. Lewis, as you know, is an atheist. He thought there was too much evil in the world, so there couldn't be a good God. Then one day he had an epiphany, and he ultimately wrote it in the book Mere Christianity. Here's what he wrote. He said, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, there's no way to know what injustice is unless you know what justice is. You can't say something is not right unless you know what is right. So the very idea that there's evil out there shows that God exists. In fact, Lewis also put it this way. The shadows prove the sunshine. In order to have shadows, you have to have sunshine. Oh, you can have sunshine without shadows. You can have good without evil, but you can't have shadows without sunshine. You can't have evil without good. So again, evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God. So, there's more we could talk about the moral argument, but let's wrap this up here. And remember we spoke about in the beginning that I was going to try and show you that there really is a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, sustaining creator out there. I think from these three arguments we can draw at least most of those attributes. From the cosmological argument, we can see that this being is immaterial, timeless, and spaceless. How so? Why can we make that conclusion? Because material time and space were created, so whatever created the universe can't be made of material time and space. You with me on that? It's got to be outside of material time and space. Also, the being must be extremely powerful because he created out of nothing. Do you realize that we create out of pre-existing material? God creates out of nothing. No space, no matter, no time. What is nothing? Aristotle had a good definition of nothing. He said, nothing is what rocks dream about. That's nothing. From the design argument, we can see that this being is extremely intelligent. Why? Because he put this together with extreme precision. And we can also see that this being sustains creation and has purpose. Just about everywhere you look, there's final causality going on. There's goal-directedness. Things are moving toward a goal. That requires an external intellect to keep them moving in that direction. That's a sustaining cause. And from the moral argument, we can see that this being is absolutely morally perfect, and he's also personal. How do we know he's personal from the moral argument? Because you only have a moral obligation to persons. You don't have a moral obligation to impersonal forces. If you go try and dunk a basketball, you're not sinning against the law of gravity. Okay, you only sin against persons. We also know that this being is personal from the cosmological argument. You say, how so? Because in order to go from a state of nothingness to a state of creation, someone had to make a choice, and only persons make choices. Impersonal forces don't make choices. Gravity doesn't go, look, if Turek drops that remote one more time, I'm not going to pull it to the ground. Watch, he's going to do it now. Not going to do it. No. It does the same thing over and over again. So notice, we have an immaterial, timeless, spaceless, extremely powerful, extremely intelligent, sustaining creator that has purpose, who's absolutely morally perfect and personal. This is the God of biblical Christianity identified without reference to the Bible. We haven't even opened the Bible yet, and we have these attributes, which appear to be the attributes of the God of the Bible. Now, does this mean that the God of the Bible is true at this point? Not necessarily. Why? Because we don't even know anything about Jesus now. This could be another God out there who is a theistic God. Maybe this is the God of Judaism alone. Or maybe this is the God of Islam, right? Because that's a theistic God as well. We simply don't know at this point which one of these theisms is true. We seem to have good evidence that atheism is true, but which one? Not atheism, but atheism. So if God wanted to show us which one is true, what could he do? What could he do? He could do something only he could do, and that would be a miracle. That's what we're going to start with tomorrow. We're going to do our miracles possible, and is the New Testament true? So we'll do miracles tomorrow in the New Testament. Actually, I won't do miracles tomorrow. Dick said he's going to do a couple in the morning, though. I'm just going to talk about them. So if you're here at 9 tomorrow morning, then maybe you'll see a miracle, because you did tell me you were going to do that, Dick. Now, maybe we have time for a couple of questions before we go. Is that okay?